prior to it, or is it just...
Well, in the parasite marriage, the phobic symptoms are exhibited in either one or both of them. And they are simply a defense mechanism of how they're trying to handle their anxieties. And they're neurotic as a defense. In other words, they've moved into a new form of relationship with other people. Now this is an intimate or so-called intimate relationship of marriage. They are frightened by that experience and become acutely fearful to the point of developing a neurotic pattern called a phobia. And it is a kind of defense reaction to the point of sometimes being an incapacitating fear. Now, obviously, if you want to be taken care of, you get more afraid, so somebody comes along to take care of you. Problem is, that worked when you were a little tiny kid, but you're not a little kid anymore. So we got two little kids grown up in big people bodies who are still relating as if they're a little tiny kid scared of the world. The transactional analysis people have a brilliant way of looking at this. They draw a diagram of a big people with a little tiny people inside hidden. Who peeps out at the world at points. Now with these people, something should be remembered. They have rage reactions that practically raise the roof. After all, there's only one chair that somebody can be taken care of in their life. And if the other party is sitting in there and you want to be taken care of, you've got to kick them out. Kick them off the chair. It's like a continual game of King of the Mountain. Coupled with kick the can. Ever play kick the can? I never played kick the can until I visited my grandmother in Detroit, Michigan, and the kids in the inner city neighborhood played kick the can in a vacant lot down the street. The idea was you hid until the guy who was it got far enough away from the can that you could run up there and kick the living daylights out of it before he got back to it. Sneak attack. I think it was a good preparation for Cold War tactics of guerrilla warfare. Alrighty. That's another type of marriage. And the next type of marriage is actually one in which there are three types. And this marriage is a paranoid marriage. There's been a lot of literature written about a paranoid marriage, beginning back in the 1930s, and continuing to do so. Roughly, we can see the pattern as evolving into three different types, and I'll talk about them as we go along. The literature that I'm using dates back to 59, 39, 68, 1942, 54, 74, and a book that came out in 76. So it's been something that's been looked at for a while. Of the four types of sick marriages that we've been looking at, the paranoid marriage, I think, is probably the most helpful in seeing the need for what is called separation and individualization of each marriage partner. I'm going to talk about separation and individualization at a later time, but we'll introduce it at this point, showing how it works when it doesn't work. Separation and individualization is actually a stage of growth which takes place in every child, or is, needs to take place in every child, at a very early age. It's the process of separating from one's major parental figure, usually mother, and standing on one's own two feet as an individual and growing. There are several patterns which exist within the scope of the paranoid marriage. And we see them as a continuum. And the far side of the continuum is here, and the other far side of the continuum is there, and then the middle side has two possibilities in it. Just simply call it a paranoid marriage. In the Folie Adulte marriage, which is French, I don't know if I pronounced that right or not, But essentially, it means madness in two. That's the literal translation of it. Fully is madness, and can be translated in, at, to, by, for, from, and with. I simply choose in. Dearth is two. This is the situation of a marriage in which each party, each partner in the marriage, gets along very well with each other. And the reason they get along pretty well is because both of them share the same delusional system. They're both paranoid. So the only conflict they have is with reality. Terrible that they can't live in a vacuum with each other. And the conflict, the madness of two aspect of paranoid marriage, is one then in which the couple shares the same paranoid delusions, and thus they get along together, but they have conflict with reality. On the other end of the spectrum is the conjugal paranoia. And this is a situation where one partner in the marriage has a delusional system, paranoid system, which is focused on the behavior of the other partner. So we've got one crazy one who blames the other one for everything. And the delusional partner, thus in this type of marriage, is allowed to function without conflict outside of the marriage. Works pretty well. They can even make the first million this way, or their second, or their third, or fourth, or they can be poor all their life, or in between. You see, what happens in the conjugal paranoid marriage situation is that the marriage partner who is delusional functions terribly in the marriage because the other partner is party to the system of craziness. And then the person is free to function quite well without delusional types of activities outside the marriage. This is the type of person in the marriage that thinks the spouse is always going out on him or her. A simple beginning of this is the mistrust and the jealousy. It can become a full-blown system. In between these two extremes, and by the way, we'll come back and look at each one of these. In between the two extremes, there are two types of variants. And the one type is, with varying degrees, the partners hold in common a number of things, such as ideas, values, prejudices, distortions, or denials of reality. In other words, they share some aspect of delusional thinking in common, either an idea or a value or a prejudice or distortion. A prejudice probably is the easiest one to illustrate this. All blacks are criminals. And if you're not careful, they'll kill you. So you got to get them first. That's a delusional system. Totally false and not in keeping with reality. But both adhere to this. They walk around in their white sheets with little holes cut out in their forehead. Not well. You see, as long as they maintain these ideas, or this small combination of ideas, or a number of combination of ideas, values or prejudice or distortions or denials of reality, as long as they maintain those in common, they have a harmony within the marriage. Can't live too well outside of the marriage, but they have a harmony in the marriage. Now, a little towards the end here of the conjugal paranoia is the group that does not have a whole lot of things in common. A couple that doesn't have a lot of things in common. And in fact, there are various degrees in which the partners disagree over conflicting values, ideas, prejudice, distortions, or denials of reality of which each one may hold. And Obviously, this type of marriage is going to have its round one, its round two, and its round three, four. A number of arguments will occur. Extensively so. Let's look at each one of these with a little more detail. When we look at the folie à deux, or the madness in two marriage, one of the things which begins to be seen is that this is sick. That not only is the relationship sick that these people have, but they're sick too. And somehow their sickness emerges when one of them falls apart. Back in 1860 is the first reported clinical literature on this subject. And the reason it was written up in 1860 is because two members of the same family were hospitalized on the same day, suffering from the same delusions or similar delusions. Paranoid ideation happened over in France. I repeat that. Two people from the same family were hospitalized on the same day, suffering from similar paranoid delusions. Very excellent chapter in the first volume of a six-volume set called The American Handbook of Psychiatry, where Dr. Cameron has written an article on paranoid conditions and paranoia. He describes in part some of this material. Clinically, or diagnosis, if you're interested, this is a psychosis of association. What that means is that a transference of the delusional ideas or the paranoid ideas or of the abnormal behavior of one of these people has been transferred to others, in particular, who have some intimate relationship with this person. Let me describe the typical pattern then. The typical pattern is one in which... Move it down? Okay. Right there. The typical pattern is one in which there is a dominant psychotic person who provokes a delusional development. Delusional means an idea about something which does not fit reality. For instance, if I were having a delusion that would be like this, I would say that you're looking at me and you're thinking evil thoughts about me because of the way you're looking. I don't know that. But see, in my delusional thinking, I have to assume he's out to get me. And that if I turn my back, he's going to clobber me over the head. He's going to use the whole wall with it, and the rest of you are going to gang up on me. You all would have to be in cahoots with each other, have a plan developed, or something which would take a huge amount of your time, of which none of you have time to do in reality. And maybe don't even think about in reality. And yet, within the delusional system of this psychotic person who is dominant in the marriage, this delusional development is provoked in the relatively dependent or submissive partner in the marriage. To the extent that the dependent person in the marriage assumes the craziness of the dominant psychotic partner, and they go in league together. The problem with that is the dependent person, or the less dominant person, is probably going to deteriorate under the delusion assumed from her partner or his partner. And in the clinical studies, I think it's most intriguing to see this work. Because when the dependent person gets separated from the dominant sick one, the dominant psychotic person, after a few months of separation, they're cleared up as all get out. and no delusion. Go ahead. Both of them have those needs. I have one situation. I worked with a person for a long period of time who bought into her spouse's system of delusional outlook on life. Everyone was out to get him. He was a very successful man. And she had to protect him as if he needed protection. And she had set out for herself a course of suicide. Without killing herself, you know, like doing herself in, or overdose of sleeping pills, or cutting her wrist, or something like this. She was going to simply starve herself to death. Amazing what happened. When she finally got to the point where she needed to be hospitalized, how she started to clear up. Paranoid reactions and paranoid schizophrenia with perceptionary types of delusions are the usual psychotic picture here. Paranoid reactions or paranoid schizophrenia with perceptional delusions. Things are not there that or don't seem to be what they are. I'll let you go read some of the texts in our library to see all that involved, but the behavior which occurs in the persons who have been living together like this is not usually somebody who has just gotten married. But this will occur in people, marriages who have been married for a while. We're not talking about 1 or 2 years of marriage. We're talking about more than that. 5, 6, 10, maybe even longer than that. And the people then have been living together for some period of time, and the dependent person has a choice to make. And they face the choice of fighting the delusional system of their mate and chancing the permanent loss of that mate. And the marriage disintegrates. Or accepting the delusional system in order to maintain the relationship. And that's the way they see their alternatives. Though this is not the situation, it reminds me of the types of things that I've seen with people who have been physically abused. Children who've been physically abused, brought into the hospital with cigarette burns over their body. The parents have put the cigarettes out on as punishment, or dropped into scalding hot bathtubs, or other types of atrocities. The kid begins to heal and they're scared to death of being away from the family. Why? Because as bad as the family is in the physically abusive system, they know how to deal with that sick family. They don't know how to deal with one they don't know about. And that's scarier for them than to be in the abusive situation. Well, in some ways, there's a parallel with this type of situation. The more dependent person here is faced with losing that which they have in the marriage, which is valued to them, by fighting the delusional system that's laid out by the dominant marriage partner, or accepting. The dependent person forms a delusional aspect as an attempt to recover a lost, significant person to them. This is an answer to Don's implied question as to, does the dependent person need the marriage for some needs on their part? And yes, they do. A recent study was done in this area, and it concluded that there were some predispositions in individuals that would enter a marriage such as this. The predisposition of the individual to acquire a delusion from his or her marriage partner. And the suggestion was, conclusion was, that there were four types involved, or classifications. And these are the four here: schizophrenia, subnormality of intellectual capacitation, either mild or borderline mental retardation, an old term with a new meaning to it, or relatively new interpretation, called demenia, which used to simply mean madness or insanity. Now it's used to be an organic loss of intellectual function. So if brain cells are dying at the rate that they're dying in all of us, as you get older, you're losing some brain cells, your brain doesn't function in the same way, you have an organic problem in that process. It's not saying that you're becoming senile or that you are senile, it just means that you're not functioning in the same way that you used to, more prone to this type of behavior happening. Also can be with organic brain syndrome. And certain types of personality disorders. Now, for those of you who have not had personality theories, or I don't know if you dealt with personality or disorders or not when you did, some of you are taking personality theories from me and we will deal with it somewhere down the road. A personality disorder is different from a neurotic or psychotic behavior pattern. A personality disorder is a deeply ingrained, maladaptive pattern of behavior. A deeply ingrained, maladaptive pattern of behavior, generally lifelong in its duration, and consequently can be recognizable usually by adolescence or earlier. And its effect is primarily on the person's personality or characterological structure. There are a wide variety of nomenclatures used for personality disorders: schizoid, hysterical, antisocial, inadequate, paranoid, passive-aggressive, and so forth, and some others. Yeah. Okay. A deeply ingrained, maladaptive pattern of behavior, which is generally lifelong in duration, and because it is that, can be recognized usually by adolescence or earlier. Antisocial person, you get an image of what that kind of person is. An explosive personality, does that connote an image to you? A person who has an inadequate personality, they're not really a full person. For some reason, their characterological structure has flaws in it that keep them from functioning as a whole person as such. Or the passive-aggressive person. He's very passive at other times and hauls off and is totally aggressive at other times. Or the schizoid person who is somewhat withdrawn, aloof, bizarre even at points. The recent studies have suggested, at least, that some character disorders, organic disorders, some areas of mental retardation and schizophrenia predispose a person towards accepting the delusional system of the more dominant marriage partner. Personality disorder. You see, what happens in this marriage of the madness of two, the social environment is such that it helps precipitate the delusions of the paranoid marriage. And in fact, sometimes it determines the type of delusions that the marriage will exhibit.
Yeah.
Well, as I mentioned before, the dependent person here, who we've just described as the one who has some predisposition to being affected by a delusion, when they separate from the stimulus for that delusion, they clear up. If that's going to be a delusional situation, yeah. It can be. Not always the same. Let me give you an illustration of this. Another one in addition to one that I gave you. Had a couple who I saw. The woman was of borderline intelligence, meaning she was not mentally retarded, but she also wasn't the most brilliant of people that you would meet either. And because of her cognitive deficits, she was very vulnerable to the wishes and desires and even irrational thinking of other people. And she married a guy who was very delusional in his thinking about the world. He carried two loaded shotguns across the back end of his pickup cab. If you didn't have a sunburned neck and wear a cowboy hat and cowboy boots, you better look out. And fortunately, where he lived, most people had sunburned necks and wore cowboy hats and boots. He was a raw person in the way that he lived. You know, everybody was out to get him. The whole world was against him in his eyes. And he convinced his wife that that was true. And literally, she closed herself up in her pantry and didn't come out for 2 days on one occasion. She wouldn't come to church. She never combed her hair for a period of time. One of her kids ran around without pants on. He was 6 years old. She totally withdrew into an environment that she was scared to death. And finally, her parents signed a mental health warrant to have her picked up and evaluated at a clinic. The psychiatrist took one look at her in the pitiful condition that she was in. And there was no question in their mind that they would order hospitalization. And they did. And I'll tell you, 90 days later, that woman was a changed woman. She was still borderline intelligence, but she wasn't locking herself up in the pantry. She wasn't hiding underneath the bed. She wasn't seeing snakes on the floor. And the wall didn't have a big mouth in it talking to her, telling her to die. Or if it took a horse's dose of Thorazine to help her. She was a different woman because she got out of the paranoid system that she was living in. He simply was crazy. That's the only thing I can say about it. That's being polite. Well, she went into an emotional breakdown. But when I described it a little while ago clinically, we have a dominant psychotic person with delusions, and they get their somewhat less independent, meaning their dependent spouse, to live in within their same delusional system. The problem is that though this dominant psychotic person somehow can handle their paranoid ideation without getting too much trouble, he fortunately hadn't shot anybody yet. Though I was a little bit concerned about that. He could handle his kind of stuff. But she couldn't handle that. And when she got into the delusional system, it blew her out of the saddle. I only have this from observation of a friend of mine working with him. I wouldn't work with him. The 10-foot pole.
What would they do with a character like that?
Huh?
What would they do with a character like that?
With him?
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of those people running around that don't do anything bad to anybody, and there's nothing they can do about them until they can convince somebody that they're of danger to themselves or somebody else. Fortunately, no. She went back to the marriage and she was back in the hospital in 6 weeks. And she went out, she went back to the marriage the second time, and she was back in the hospital in 4 weeks. And that's the last contact I had with the couple. I would assume that that pattern would continue to go on. Real hard to break that system. You see, because she was who she was and had an outlook on herself and the way which she did, she didn't think she could live without him. After all, he's so powerful. Just look at those two shotguns in the back end of his pickup. Just listen to him. Well, the world would have to be crazy to defy him. And this is Article 8, Doctrines and Practices Disapproved. And Section 5 is entitled Divorce and Remarriage. And I think it's sort of interesting. I'll read it to you. Paragraph A, Membership. Subparagraph 1, Marriage Estrangements Before Conversion. There are now among Christian people those who became entangled in their marriage relationships in their former lives of sin and who do not see how these matters can be adjusted. We recommend that these people be received into membership of the local assemblies and that their marriage complications be left in the hands of the Lord. Parentheses, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 17, 20, and 24. In parentheses. Paragraph 2, Common Law Marriage. We recommend that in no case shall persons be accepted into fellowship who are known to be living in a common law state of matrimony. Paragraph B, Remarriage. Low standards on marriage and divorce are very hurtful to individuals, to the family, and to the cause of Christ. Therefore, we discourage divorce by all lawful means and teaching. We positively disapprove of Christians getting divorces for any cause except fornication and adultery. Matthew 19:9. Where these exceptional circumstances exist, or when a Christian has been divorced by an unbeliever, we recommend that the question of remarriage be resolved by the believer as he walks in the light of God's Word. And again, we have a citation of 1 Corinthians chapter 7, but now verses 15, 27, and 28. Paragraph C. Local church leadership, subparagraph 1, standard for offices of bishop or elder and deacon. Since the New Testament restricts divorced and remarried believers from the church offices of bishop or elder and deacon, we recommend that this standard be upheld by all our assemblies. Reference Titus 1, verses 5 through 9, 1 Timothy 3, 12. However, we recommend that all other opportunities for Christian service for which these believers may be qualified be made available to them.
Thus, that would include Sunday school teaching, etc. Paragraph, subparagraph 2, prerogative of the local assemblies. It is understood that recommendations are not binding, but local assemblies shall maintain the prerogative of setting their own standards, parentheses, in accordance with the provisions of Article 11 of the Constitution, end parentheses. Paragraph D, performing marriage ceremonies, subparagraph 1, ministerial guidelines. We disapprove of any Assemblies of God minister performing a marriage ceremony for anyone who has been divorced and whose former companion is still living, unless his case is included in the exceptional circumstances described in Article 8, Section 5, Paragraph B. Remember which I read over here, which had to do with remarriage, having to do with the exceptions are fornication and adultery. Any minister of our fellowship who performs a ceremony for a disapproved marriage, parentheses indicated above, end parentheses, unless he has been innocently deceived into doing so, may be dismissed from the fellowship. As Assemblies of God, an Assemblies of God minister is required to counsel applicants for marriage ceremonies with Scripture guidelines for the Christian marriage prior to the performing of the ceremony. Interesting statement. He may not perform ceremonies for persons who, in the minister's opinion, approach marriage without proper forethought, wisdom, and sobriety. Paragraph, subparagraph 2, violation of conscience not required. We realize that the remarrying of such persons included in the acceptive circumstances of Article 8, Section 5, Paragraph B could violate the conscience of a minister. And if this should be the case, the minister should not be expected to perform such ceremonies. Paragraph E, ministerial credentials. We disapprove of any married minister of the Assemblies of God holding credentials if either minister or spouse has a former companion living. And it's reference to paragraph 7, section 2, paragraphs I and J, end quote. All right, that's the statement from the Constitution Revised Assemblies of God Version that we were referring to last time. Yeah.
I was wondering, I've heard of cadence, but there are problems that
some people may define that as such. However, as you will hear me talk in a future lecture, obsessive concern about virginity is a neurotic pattern of love. Obsessive concern about virginity is an exhibition of neurotic characteristics of love. And Paul's use of the term fornication in 1 Corinthians is equivalent to adultery. Not something previous to marriage. Which is interesting, to say the least. So, in some people's minds, I suppose they would affirm your statement. In others, they would disaffirm it. specifically, the statement doesn't speak to it, but speaks to a marriage situation. Even though it does use the term fornication and adultery. Donald? That's true. Connotation-wise, yeah. I will make my statement again. Excessive concern about virginity in love relationships is an exhibition of neurotic characteristics of love. Well, if you want to be technical about the situation, if you have a sexual thought of committing sexual intercourse with another individual, regardless at what age you are, you have committed fornication and adultery, or adultery. Does somebody want to apply that to the letter of the law? Right. I'm debating if I'm going to give you a direct answer or how. I'll give you an illustration. My wife and I used to, after our evening service in San Francisco and my first student pastorate, like to go over to Berkeley, across the Bay Bridge to a black church over there. It had a radio broadcast at 10 o'clock at night, which was enough time to get done with our prayer service and a gang of us go over. We liked it because they had good music, three choirs, and four different colored robes, and they did a lot of clapping style, and it was fun, and it was good fellowship. But the bishop who pastored the church had one sermon topic, which every time you heard him preach, it didn't make any difference where he took his text from. He always preached about the same thing. Adultery. Adultery. That's all he preached about was adultery. It didn't make any difference if he was talking about crossing the Red Sea or the woman taken in adultery that's mentioned in the Gospels. It wasn't any difference. The only thing I can assume from that is apparently he was very hyper-concerned about adultery in his own life. And so he projected it onto everybody else. And maybe the prohibition that is so strong has an emotional base to it in terms of one's own fear. So you've got to preach it so strong so you don't do it. Well, that's the heavy answer. Yet, being the kind of analytically oriented person that I am, I can't escape the heavy answer involved with it. Back to the issue, is it right or wrong to make one sin bigger than the other? Well, I think Jesus dealt with that pretty well back in the New Testament time period when he walked around dealing with people like the Pharisees. So then I sit here with an experience in my own background of my father's suspension for 6 months and then another 6 months because he and my mother got a divorce. Suspension being no ministry, approved of
for that period of time. And then on the other hand, I see that even some districts offered indirectly to license my stepfather after he and my mother got married. Well, that's a cardinal sin. And they would have done so in defiance of Springfield because of their respect.